Welcome to season 4, episode 4. In this episode, I interview Maggie Jackson, who is an award-winning author and journalist known for her pioneering writings on social trends, particularly technology's impact on humanity. Her acclaimed book, Distracted, kickstarted a global conversation on the steep costs of fragmenting our attention and won the 2020 Dorothy Lee Book Award for Outstanding Scholarship in the Ecology of Culture. She's a former contributing columnist for the Boston Globe and has written for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and other publications worldwide. Her 2021 essay on uncertainty was named Best of the Foreign Press by Le Monde's Paris-based weekly Courrier International. I interview Maggie for her book, Uncertainty, and it's a thought-provoking, inspiring, and I think helpful conversation for a lot of us to reflect on the role that uncertainty plays in our life. I want to jump right into our conversation, but first I'll just mention a few key quotes from the book that I think are powerful and great things for us to think about as we focus on this topic of uncertainty. One of those quotes is that too often people typically spring into action based on what first comes to mind, and thus too often wind up seeing the world through the lens of what they already know. We will talk more about that in this conversation, and I think it's something that is very supported by neuroscience research and the term predictive processing, which is a big part of this book, as well as what I call predictive perception. Another interesting excerpt from the book that came from some studies is that those who had been primed to learn, and this is in contrast to those who were primed to win an argument, the people who had been primed to learn began to see knowing as inherently uncertain and as something best forged from multiple viewpoints. Such thinkers do not merely tolerate the realm of the indefinite, they actively seek its potential. For within that bewildering zone lies transformation itself. I love this because a very big part of our conversation is reframing what uncertainty means, that it actually is a zone of potential. It is a space of possibility. And too often we are trying to use the idea of knowing as a form of control, and this keeps us from opening up to that space of potential and possibility. Another quote from the book is that highly inquisitive people tend to share one quality, a willingness to tolerate the stress of the new and unexpected. I think this is also something for us to keep in mind, not only for our work or how we seek out information, but also within our relationships, that when we can tolerate some of the stress that happens as we let go of trying to control a situation, it can help us open up those attentional mechanisms that may help us be more highly attuned and therefore accurate to what is going on within our social dynamics. What I love about this, and we also talk about it in the interview, is the reframing of what that arousal means when it comes to uncertainty, that many people find it stressful, but what we uncover in this conversation and Maggie looks at throughout the book is that the reframing of arousal and that feeling of discomfort is a really key part as well of harnessing the power of uncertainty and unfamiliar feelings and that potentially stressful feeling that comes from not knowing the answers. But by reframing that feeling into an understanding that our body is actually becoming primed to learn, to engage in a state of what Stanislas Dehaene calls wakeful learning, that when we can understand that our body is responding to not knowing in a way that's actually extremely helpful for us, this can help us tap into what Maggie calls the vitality of a curiosity-driven approach. And one last thing I'd like to highlight from the book that I found fascinating is something that Maggie looked at called reward-driven distraction. What studies have found is that Some people, when they are in demanding situations, might underperform by succumbing to paralysis by analysis or anxiety. A lot of this is influenced by something called reward-driven distraction, which is that people become mesmerized by the stakes of the situation and the potential reward of it. As they do this, they become less engaged in their bodies, and it can make it harder for them to actually perform well. So a really interesting intervention that has been looked at is, for example, with athletes, where they get trained to use cue words that help them nudge their attention away from the future consequences of their play and back into the twists and turns of the game. So for example, a competitor might tell themselves in the middle of the game to focus on every play. And a similar practice that Maggie also includes in this section of the book involves giving a deliberate look called the quiet eye to important elements in the scene in order to reorient yourself to the current moment. I think there's a lot of valuable lessons to those ideas about not getting so mesmerized by the stakes or the future consequences of what's happening, and to come back into the twists and turns of the play, to have that wakeful sense of learning and eyes that are really tuned in to the moment and to the present. That is, in many ways, where uncertainty lies. When we're staying truly open and truly present, it means that we are staying open to not knowing what's next and to allowing for that moment to play out and to trust our own intelligence and the intelligence of life and the situation to guide our actions and our ability to constantly tune in and stay agile and flexible to everything that continues to emerge in each moment. And as you'll hear in our conversation, this ties into a lot of research on resilience as well. So thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy the interview. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Maggie. I have been reading your book and absolutely loving it. And I think it's such a great topic too for all of us. So thanks for coming.
Oh, thank you for having me. And I'm so happy to see how well and how richly our work aligns.
It really does. You know, we had a previous conversation, and so many light bulbs went off for me, and it's very synergistic what the work we're doing. So really excited to have you on. So I wanted to start with two things that came to mind right away is why the topic of uncertainty, how did that come to be? And then also even your journey, even from childhood, just where you are now and how you got to be where you are now.
Sure. Yes. Well, just briefly, I backed into the topic of uncertainty, although later I realized it fits me and fits my work very, very well. But after I wrote a book about distraction called Distracted and Attention, I wanted to write a book about thinking, because that seemed like the natural alter ego or complement to a book on focus. And so both, focus and attention are vehicles for something. Well, what do you do with your focus? You know, thinking is really important. They go hand in hand. And I started that book, and I was writing a book on the kinds of thinking that we perhaps most need in a time of tech saturation and fragmentation. And the first chapter was uncertainty, but I really thought that was it. You know, uncertainty merited a kind of a preface, and then you got into the meat of what good thinking was. And I discovered two things. One, this explosion of research, new findings that are unpacking for the first time how uncertainty works in the human, and, you know, how it's actually a form of wisdom. And then secondly, I found that it wasn't just a preface to good thinking, but it's an accompaniment. It's a very, very important aspect of human thinking, creativity, curiosity, resilience, mental well-being, every step of the way. So we've shuffled this aspect of life under the rug in many ways to our detriment. And I wanted to pull it out and examine it and then share my really amazing findings.
Amazing. Yeah. So it's so interesting to have this, you have this pinpointed range in a sense of, well, a volatile pinpointed range of attraction and distraction. attention and distraction, like that focus. And then it seems like it went the other way, almost expanded outward.
Yes. Yeah, so I think of attention as being a human faculty that's extraordinarily important to have, but that's not the end point. You also need how to manage your mind and to reflect and to follow a train of thought and as well as to notice and heed and evaluate gut thinking and all these different kinds of thinking. So attention and thought really go hand in hand. And that's how I sort of thought about it.
Mm, I love that. And it makes me think of, I always think of it as like the spotlight or beam of awareness. And we sometimes have it very tight. And then there's other times where it's very diffused. So there's this kind of dance between all of that. And we tend to, there are some people that think we need to always have it very focused and controlled in a sense. But what we're looking at in this book as well is how important it is sometimes to let go of that control as well.
Yes, that's true. I think that's very true in uncertainty as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So a little more about you and your journey as an author is whatever comes to mind, it would be nice to hear.
Sure. Yes, again, kind of working backwards, I hadn't realized until I was maybe nearly done with the Uncertain book that this was the end of a trilogy. The first book before Distracted was called What's Happening to Home? I don't love the title, but in any case, it was about the nature of home in the digital age. Mm. And then I tackled attention. And then finally, I found my way, or uncertainty found me. So these were three big picture topics, amorphous subjects, difficult to explain, but yet, so important, threaded, through our lives in so many ways. And so it was really interesting because I spent quite a bit of time on these three books. But just before that, I have been a reporter, a journalist who gravitated toward books. I worked abroad for a number of years in Tokyo and in London, but working all over Europe and Asia, and then came back and was one of the first work-life balance columnists in the country. So I studied work-life and workplace issues. So I was sort of taking the lens of looking at these cultures that I was an outsider in and looking at big picture social subjects. And that's one reason why I probably wrote these books on, but I've always been interested in sort of big, messy topics.
Yeah.
Wherever I go. And now I grew up around Boston. I went to college in Connecticut. And then shortly after that, I moved to Japan, which was, a really great, wonderful way to gain perspective on one's identity, on one's country, on one's childhood, to have that outsider view. But also I'll just add as a personality dimension that perhaps fits in with uncertainty. I've always felt like an outsider. I was adopted, but with my twin sister in Boston. So I felt as though there's this insider-outsider place in a family when you're adopted. And also I always had that ability to step back and look at my surroundings with a lot of attunement and observational skill, which probably came to some extent emerged from the precarity that I grew up with, not only during the adoption. I was adopted, in my first year of life, but still, and then also moving into an unpredictable, erratic family situation. Mm-hmm. And so that science shows, and I actually delve into this in my book, that this kind of precarity, which is not something we would wish on anyone in terms of survival, nor do we ever want uncertainty to be limitless. Uncertainty is not the goal. Resolution and security are so important. But at the same time, people placed in more precarious situations for all sorts of reasons, and adoption studies are really important to this new work on precarity. That people gain strengths or they adapt in ways that has been not recognized in the literature before. So that was really interesting to me personally as I wrote this book.
A few things come up as you say that. As we had discussed in our earlier conversation, we are not saying that when it comes to our basic needs, and especially children, anyone vulnerable, that we are advocating that a limitless uncertainty is a good thing. So we just want to premise this whole conversation with that. I think we're talking about a really key phrase that stands out to me from the book is insufficient mental models. And that when a mental model we have is insufficient, there is so much potential for what becomes a strength and becomes a higher level of awareness and lots of different things that happen. So we're looking at it through that lens. And I think also what comes out of what you're saying too, that's really powerful, is sometimes we might have this deficit view of people who have had a certain level of precarity or uncertainty in their life or challenge. But what we're actually seeing is that there are incredible strengths that come from that. And so the more we look at it through a paradigm like that, we might be able to tap into certain skills and talents and levels of resilience from a lot of different kinds of populations that we have so much to learn from that we may have neglected in the past, because we look, and like you really lay out in the book, we sometimes look at experts, the people who have this high level of certainty and this fast kind of decision making, as the ones that really know. And what we're saying is that there is space for us to actually look at the people who are presenting with that they don't know, or there is this uncertainty, that there's so much to be gained from that. So yeah, I love that you brought that up about your childhood as well. I think it's helpful for people to know that we're not going to these extremes either. It's this spectrum, and it's a dance with this whole palette of experiences. I kind of say, like, when I talk about growth mindset, so this idea that we have the capacity to change and our mindset is a very powerful driver of that. Some people go to this extreme where they're saying that's the only thing that matters. And the thing is that our environment, our context, genetics, all of that plays a role. So we don't need to go to this extreme where we're saying it's only this. This is the be all end all of what we're saying. But we're dancing with these different shades of a giant spectrum of experience. So.
Yes. No, I think that's really important. And when people are raised in precarity, sometimes they might not fit in as well or test less well on the, what schools and society expect. You mentioned that laser sustained focus, which is really important to have. But at the same time, there are other types of attentional capabilities that, you might, have outside of school. So one of the researchers who I talked to, who is at the forefront of these studies of people raised in precarity and their strengths, their hidden strengths, they call them, talks about street smarts as a kind of shorthand. That's something that maybe we can all understand, the street smarts that come from being in precarity when you have to respond quickly. And that's, we all need to pause and reflect. We all need to pay attention in a sustainable way. But at the same time, this high attunement to the environment, which is often seen in children, better working memory, more, cognitive flexibility, is precisely what scientists are beginning to find that is true when we're all uncertain, which is fascinating because when you're uncertain, basically, it usually occurs when you're meeting up with something new and surprising and unexpected and ambiguous. At that moment, your brain and your body have a stress response that is, in effect, actually priming you to learn to do two things, to move out of automatic pilot in the sense that everything is routine and you're kind of depending on your heuristic kind of thinking into the more deliberative, awakeful arousal scientists talk about. So when it's really interesting that the kind of unease of uncertainty is actually good stress. And so when people are in precarious environments, they have that high attunement. It's very, very challenging, and it has its costs as well as its benefits, but it mirrors the kind of wakefulness that it's exactly what we need. When we're meeting something, you see something, the shadow in the forest, and it could be a tiger, or it could be just a shadow, it could be a rabbit or a tiger, and the organism needs to wake up, move out of automaticity and into more deliberate. And so uncertainty is precisely the gateway. Mm-hmm. Something we fear and dread, is really the gateway to waking up to the world and then investigating. It sets us up to learn.
I love that, waking up to the world. There was a phrase in the book which was talking about kids especially and how much the brain kind of has a special, that N400 wave of this perking up that kind of happens. And it sounds like that phrase you just said, waking up to the world, where they were saying if there's no surprise, there's no learning. Because otherwise we are in that automatic mode. And so we're going through that. You have a sentence, just being willing to expect change makes us more alert to shifts in the fabric of life. What we are saying, I think, from what I'm hearing from you, is this level of attunement. It's an attunement that starts to increase as we have a level of uncertainty that is so powerful. First of all, I see this in so many different realms of life where we can be thinking about this. So this is on a societal level. This is where innovation can truly happen because we're becoming more attuned to the live data in this moment of what is emerging constantly in the world, in the challenges we face. So having that high level of attunement is going to make us better actually at innovating. So I see it on that level. I also see this on a relationship and family level because we are very often engaged in, you call it predictive processing. I like to even call it predictive perception, which is that we already have a mental model of who that family member is, how it is with them, our dynamic, their personality, their reactions, to the point where we don't even really hear what they say anymore. It's already done in our mind. And that's very much what your book touches on. It's completely predicted already. So we don't even allow for new information to happen. And this is so tragic because every organism is constantly evolving, even with micro fluctuations. And yes, we have repetitive behaviors. We all do. We all live within our own mental models and we have very similar reflexes. But in a situation, in a social dynamic, let's say with family members or any kind of social dynamic, if we're not staying attuned to the micro signals that are happening in that moment, we are not allowing that to enter our senses, or it's not becoming input for us. So we're never updating our mental model. So it becomes basically a self-fulfilling prophecy. And you see that so much in family dynamics that it's just on repeat. Whatever happened in the past continues to happen. So I really want people to hear this as well for all the social interactions they have in life, that there's so much of this predictive perception and processing happening that if we can allow for this feeling of maybe I don't know what's going on for them, maybe I don't actually know what that reaction means. It doesn't mean that we're saying, let's say if they have a certain phrasing they use with us or a certain facial expression, that might still exist. But what I think this book really brings out is this idea of what if we just allow it to be where we're exploring other possibilities of what that facial expression means or what that tone of voice might mean, really allowing for this opening up of other possibilities to just get that our senses to be way more tuned into this live moment. It's just so powerful. I think there's powerful applications for this.
Yes, and that was such a great synopsis of some of the most important points about, you know, first of all, the idea of expecting change, not walking into the Monday morning meeting thinking it's going to be the same old blah, 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 and therefore literally tuning out to both the signal of something new and the uncertainty that carries you forward to update, you know, all of that sort of veil that we put over our lives. Now, of course, it's really natural, as you say, to need predictive processing because we go through life smoothly. I don't have to relearn how to tie my shoelaces. I don't have to think about where my driveway is if I drive back into work or where the subway station is. You know, that allows us to go through life smoothly. But we're talking about the moments when smooth doesn't cut it anymore and smooth sets us back and disconnects us from the complexity that is already there. And I think that's, and there's a wonderful, to speak to your great point about relationships, a Buddhist scholar interpreting a 7th century Indian Buddhist philosopher anyhow makes an incredible point that when you meet someone on the street who you haven't seen in a while, maybe they used to work with you, you so often or almost always think of them as the same person that they were a year ago. And so you treat them similarly or you come upon them with assumptions and yet they have changed so much. And that's really, really important to be open to that. So I think what you were saying, if I can add to it, is that we can be uncertain, and that's important when we're surprised by life or blindsided or we encounter something new and ambiguous, but we can also remain open to uncertainty during all of our lives so that then we are seeking uncertainty. That's what creativity is. That's what being open to new opinions is, seeking uncertainty in order to be in a space of open-mindedness and curiosity. And that's the mark of the superior expert, so-called adaptive expert. That's also the mark of creative idea generation. You know, people who are spinning ideas need to get away from what they know and what's familiar. And that's where we all start off. One of the creativity tests is about thinking of alternative uses for household objects, very predictive of creativity, big and small C. And if you're thinking of uses for a brick, everybody starts off with walls and, you know, decks or cobblestone street, whatever. And the creative people launch into the unknown, to the remote connections. You know, the brick is the mini pizza stone or the pillow or what have you. You know, some woman at a conference actually suggested it as a toy for her dog to fetch. And well, okay, that's a strong jaw. But in any case, if you move away from the known, and that's where life, that's where people flourish. They're at the edge of life.
Yes, I love that. And that touches on, I think, another phrase you have in the book, which is transcendent thinking. Which I think is from Mary Ellen Imordino Yang.
Yes, Mary Ellen. Yes.
So just this idea of expanding beyond what's already predicted, what's already established. That is the realm that we have to go to for innovation. So I love that you talk about that. Another thing, just to come back to what we were just talking about, is this idea of smooth doesn't always mean, it doesn't always cut it. I love that, because when we think about a lot of our interactions and how we go about life, it is nice to have some things where we're not expending a lot of decision-making energy. We're not putting a lot of extra kind of thought into it. It is nice to have that. Just like you were saying, like, it would be exhausting, but kind of fun if every time I picked up a pen, I was like, wow, what is this? So, you know, there would be fun to that too, but I wouldn't get a lot done in life. So I do need some things where it's not that exciting to look at anymore. It, you know, I have a prediction of how I'm going to use it. But this idea of when things feel very efficient and automatic, there is a sense of comfort we have for that, because it's not expending energy. And we are energy conserving systems. That's so much of what the brain is doing, is just trying to conserve energy. So it feel like there's almost a visceral feeling of, this feels right almost, this feels better because it conserves energy. That's the part that I think we have to understand that we're always playing with, is that just because things feel, and I'm putting that in air quotes, on this internal level, a little bit easier or familiar, doesn't mean it's better. And it doesn't mean it's actually going to help you in future terms have a better life or easier life or any of that. So it's just in that particular moment, it feels less energy expending, but that is not really the ingredient for growth. And I love the term you say, adaptive expert, where we can become adaptive experts of life, which is, there's so much agility and flexibility needed for that, that there's always going to be some expenditure of energy to face new things, to allow our mind to expand in a moment. It will always feel like this, like it requires more energy in a sense. So it won't always feel good or easier for us. But what we can do, and your book touches on this as well, this word arousal, is start to associate new meaning to what arousal is within us. So if it feels like, oh, I don't like this, I don't know how to respond, or this feels uncomfortable because this is not the way I normally think about this person or this category of people, you know, those kinds of predictive perceptions as well, that if we can make new meaning about what arousal is in our body. And your book does a really amazing job of that, of starting to understand that when we're feeling this, like, and we will have a visceral feeling of arousal because there's stress hormones that are being released, all of that, it's going to make our heart rate, you know, go different. So if we can make new meaning about that, oh, this actually is a good sign. This is a sign that my current existing mental model and all the algorithms in place are insufficient. Instead of looking at that as, oh, shoot, I don't have the sufficient mental models, we're actually looking at, oh, yes, great, I'm going to get updated. I'm now expanding, new inputs are going to come in. I'm building a stronger, more adaptive, agile, robust algorithm, basically, inside of me.
And I just came across a new study of doctors who found that literally reported that the discomfort of an uncertain situation was highly linked to heightened attention, which is, you know, underscores the neural studies. And then also it was highly linked to an alertness to looking forward to muster resources to deal with the situation. So they were revved up, and it is really important. So instead of squandering or fearing or denying that kind of discomfort, we need to recognize that that's precisely what's tuning us in and waking us up. And as you're saying, doing, you know, all moving us out of the easy chair and into, you know, the life itself and figuring out, which again is not where we always can or want to be, but it's really important. And then also, I think it's important to note that in our society, there's so many messages that are opposite to that, that, you know, basically one example would be, well, first of all, we are, I think, beginning to understand that there can be good stress. But for the most part, especially in times of flux and volatility, people seek comfort. I mean, during the height of the early pandemic, people bought guns, puppies, cash, and hot dogs. You know, they wanted comfort. And that's natural to offset all of the volatility they were seeing. But when we only respond by retreating into the routine or the familiar, we are you know, saying no to opportunities to expand our horizons, to understand what's really going on, to learn, to grow, et cetera. And so there are so many messages that we can gain outcome, that technology gives us instant answers, that things are neat and pat, and that this is the way to be in an efficiency society. And that is mistaken, largely mistaken, that humans are made, just as we're learning, humans are made to exercise, not in small pockets of a half an hour jog, but all the time, and be a moving creature. So too, humans are built to, you know, to live most fully if they're on that edge of what they can know, not just, you know, remaining on an island of what to know. And another illustration is that in groups, in collaborative groups, actually, the groups that are most creative and most have the most intense discussions and are most accurate in studies after studies and all sort from climbing teams on Mount Everest to workplace teams, those are the groups that are typically airing differences, you know, allowing dissent. They are, you know, being kind of open to the friction that it comes from having diverse, different people, which all humans are. And one of the things that does is this disagreement works, not because one side emerges victorious over the other and then things get better. No, actually, dissent, even if wrong, provokes the same performance gains. It's the uncertainty. A group in a disagreement is jolted off their accord, their agreement, their lazy information processing, and then into skeptical, wakeful, you know, a form of group arousal. And yet, groups that are in agreement rate themselves as doing better as groups that are in disagreement. Groups that are in disagreement don't actually see that they're doing better, even though they are stunningly better on so many different performance measures. So that's part of, I think, moving forward, updating our cultural ideals of what is good. There will always be an innate human ideal of ease, because that is, you know, expending less energy and being more efficient in a certain way. But I think culturally, we need to understand that, you know, discomfort is, as we were saying, smooth doesn't always cut it. When life is complicated, you have to surf what's going on around you, and uncertainty allows you to do that.
As you say that, to me, smooth means existing model. Smooth means your existing mental model. So the bigger that gets, the more expansive and system interconnected that gets, the better it actually is. So I love that that's such a powerful example in terms of the groups, because it highlights two things. One is that the ones that were in agreement perceived themselves as doing well, doing better. So there again is that highlighting of that. We like the feeling of agreeing. We like the politeness and the agreement that happens. It's so much easier on an energetic level, because we don't have to do much with that. We get to just feel, we get the good, some of the neurochemicals there as well. We're socially valued. We don't fear being ostracized or excluded from the group because everyone agrees. But what you saw in that research is that even though our perception, that incredible feeling we have that we think this I'm on the right track might actually be deceiving us sometimes. And there, that's such a beautiful illustration of that, which also leads to some other thoughts that came up from the book too, in terms of our use of, you know, the internet, social media. And then I want to bring up the word control as well, which is coming to mind. So with just drawing off that study and looking at our behavior online, we are generally going to feel better in air quotes, when we're not using a huge amount of energy. And so getting, you know, feeds of people that say the same thing we already think is always going to feel, in air quote, better. It's going to feel easier. I'll say easier, maybe not better, easier. So that's important for us to understand that that doesn't necessarily mean that we are learning anything. It's simply just that it's energy efficient to get validation for what we already think and for that agreement. The other aspect, the word control, comes to mind because we do like to have a feeling of control. And so that is a lot of what the brain is using its energy for as well. This idea of predictability is a way to control, because otherwise, if we didn't have that capacity, we would be using too much energy all the time to be making all of these decisions, and we wouldn't survive very long. So, you know, there is a sense of, we also, it's not just ease, but we like the feeling that if we can kind of predict. So, and I'm going to go back into, you know, family dynamics and these social interactions, that there is also this feeling that if we really allow ourselves to actually tune into the moment, and we don't use our predictive models, we don't use our that kind of processing, we don't immediately have our argument ready because we already kind of know what they're going to say or whatever that is, there's a feeling of lack of control. It feels very scary, because if we already think we know what they're going to do, then we have some backup. Like, we have some things that we're going to resort to very quickly. So it's a very vulnerable space to, and the hand gesture I'm using right now is I'm like moving it. It's like not a shield over you anymore. You're actually putting your hands out. And there's a vulnerability to that of saying, I'm going to stay open to the data that's coming in, but that means I can't control it. But here's the fallacy, is that sometimes we think that, okay, if I'm not really sure, I'm going to do stuff that feels like a sense of control. Like, I'll try to predict, and then I will react to the prediction I have. I'll react to the things I know, and I will say that thing, or I'll grip the reins tighter, you know, on the horse. We think that's going to give us a sense of security or control, but actually the opposite is true, because life, like you're saying, is this emergent process. Emergent is such an important word. Constant data, interconnected systems, every single organism, everything we see in this world are these fluctuating, dynamic systems that are interconnected that we can't even see. We can't see how much is you know, vibing together and all that. So our best bet is actually to have the sense of flexibility. And there's just two things that come to mind with that, which is there are these structures in South America that I visited a long time ago that have endured through many, many, many earthquakes. And one of the parts of the structure is they have a trapezoid opening, but their foundation are giant rolling boulders. And so instead of being this very rigid thing, they have a flexibility. And that, I think, is a really neat analogy for us to think about, that they actually stand the test of time because they're all these components, and it's not one single unit, lots and lots of components that roll together. That also brings me to another piece of this, where people think if certainty feels safer, but the other aspect of resilience and how we really cope with stress in adaptive ways has to do with feedback responsiveness. So it's part of a framework called regulatory flexibility, which is shown in the research to be one of the highest predictors of actual resilience, is flexibility. And feedback responsiveness is this ability, moment by moment, to take in input, to acknowledge it, monitor it in some way, and then be willing and able to cease, enhance, modify, or adjust your strategy. But it's constantly ongoing. And so they actually find that a lot of the individuals that they find to be very resilient are harder to predict in terms of what strategies they use because they're so context dependent and flexible. We tend to think certainty will give us a sense of safety. And there's truth to that too, you know, having certain structures and all that. But the truth of it is that real resilience, and I'm making motions of being very dynamic in my movement, is that that is actually really where we see resilience happen, especially when it comes to systems, and we are all systems.
Oh, exactly. And actually, in expertise, again, expert surgeons are very hard to study. Adaptive expert surgeons are hard to study because they take on the hardest cases. Oh. They're constantly pushing the envelope of what they know, extending their knowledge. So, you know, they can study adaptive expertise and know that how they operate and know that they, you know, widen the problem and test options. And they tend to actually diagnose, spend more time diagnosing a new complex problem than even novices. But at the same time, you know, it exactly exemplifies what you were just saying. They are constantly responding to new environments and working at the edge. So that's really interesting. And also, I think when you're talking about context-dependent, flexible responsiveness, one of the ways in which that can be illustrated is by new work on the marshmallow test. You know, it was never to Walter Mischel, but to the society at large, took away from the marshmallow test these very simple lessons like this, you know, wait for the second marshmallow, don't grab, you know, you're impulsive, you'll fail. And there, you know, people don't do as well in the SAT, et cetera. But as we've been talking about, there are many, many other different measures of success in life. And actually, Walter Mischel knew very well that context matter. Kids whose fathers had left the family were more likely to take the first marshmallow. Kids who are growing up in precarious situations might be more willing to take the first marshmallow. But that makes sense because when you live lives where promises are broken and where there might never be a second marshmallow, it's much wiser. It's the same old adage, the bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. And so a study by Celeste Kidd that is really interesting, she took a group of kids. Now, she didn't study their socioeconomic class. She was just studying all kids and their reaction. And basically, you know, she did an experiment where they were half the group was promised, the whole group was promised like better stickers if they waited. But in that case, half of the group never got any stickers, better stickers. They waited, and then the person came back and said, sorry. And the same thing happened for a coloring book, same thing happened for marshmallows. So by the third time, the kids who had never gotten what they waited for were in no mood to keep waiting. They had adapted. They were flexibly responsive, as you're saying, to context. And that's in another neuroscientist laboratory setting of studies of control, Mary Helen E. Mordino Yang, as you mentioned, she had a girl come in and decide in a test of basically a marshmallow, but it was a test of taking money or waiting for more money later. The girl, it was near Christmas time, holiday time, and the girl said, I want the money now because I want to give my mom the gift of a bus pass that she really needs. And so she was being as wise could be, but flouting our rigid ideas about what smart is. Smart is not always unending cognitive control any more than limitless uncertainty is important. It really is this sort of flexibility, which seems like an open-ended, difficult thing. How can we manage when we're always supposed to be open and curious? And how can we manage when we're supposed to constantly think about the next thing? But again, I think it's important to reiterate that most of life isn't like this. Most of life is, or much of life can be contended with, you know, through routine, mental models and et cetera. But when life becomes new or ambiguous or complex or surprising, bingo, that's the time that we can learn, that can update our mental models, and we can do justice to the world through being uncertain. That's why I call uncertainty a form of honesty.
That almost made me emotional just hearing those examples of how much context was infused in those moments of the choice and how much wisdom actually was there when it came to the marshmallow test. I love that they revisited that. I think that's a powerful example of what this whole idea means, which is that some people took that test and they were so certain, in a sense, of what that meant, and that's what we should then therefore apply as a rule. And what these other researchers did, they said, actually, we understand that there are so many other systems involved, so many other factors. So let's be curious and open as to what that is. And I love that just seeing this, there is a wisdom to whatever your previous environment was, you are going to respond just like you're saying, you're going to respond adaptively to the next moment. So we need to really keep that in mind as we are thinking about other solutions, ways that we are trying to help, make contributions to the world, to make society better, to be a lot more curious and uncertain about what we believe to be true about people's behaviors. So I think that is just, it's such a powerful example of what it means to have the, and you talk about in this book too, it's this, you're not racing forward to the first thing that comes to mind. You are allowing yourself to sit first and just stay open and then see what comes from that. And I think those studies really demonstrate that. So I love that. And actually that feeds into, as we kind of wrap up, I know that there was another aspect of it that had to do with the inner, there's a bit more of this inner reflection, the daydreaming that also played a role in their ability to not eat the marshmallow. I think there were some examples where when they pretended that it was a giant cloud, they did not take the marshmallow for a much longer time than the other ones that distracted themselves. So I just I'd love to touch on that just briefly as well, of there's this, and that's that kind of, I guess, that transcendent thinking of really letting our minds expand in new ways, that might actually play a role in some of these things we do kind of want, which is the impulse control sometimes and the, projecting into the future. So yeah, could you touch a little bit on that?
Yes. And I think that it's really important to emphasize that being uncertain is not willy-nilly or setting oneself adrift. Actually, people who are highly tolerant of uncertainty tend to be flexible thinkers, but they also, some studies at least, hint that they have more gray matter in regions related to executive control. And so you can see that by constantly being on your toes or open and flexible to taking situations not always at face value, you're also exercising your control. And this is particularly so in daydreaming, where it's a very, very new topic of study and hadn't really been seen as worth anyone's time in psychology or cognitive science. But finally, the default mode network, which sometimes Scott Barry Kaufman and others call the imagination network, was discovered literally. And that resting mode, that imagination mode, the default network also helps us see others' perspectives. That, to many scientists' surprise, was seen co-activating with executive networks of the brain. Mm. And scientists were baffled about why. Was the executive network trying to haul the default mode offline and go get people back on task? No, actually, because they were on task to inner agendas and the unfinished business of their lives and to the what if questions that daydreaming makes up. And what happens now, people think that theorize that these two networks, major networks, co-activate because the daydreaming is coherent. I mean, it's loosely coherent, just as we can kind of understand that narrative flavor of our REM dreams at night. They seem like stories, all wild stories, but daydreams often are, we pursue trails of thought or kind of story-like what-if questions, and that's really important. So we're talking about, you know, ways to manage our mind even beyond the just racing to an answer or black and white thinking or rigidly sticking to the familiar and routine. We're talking about structures and capabilities that can be skillfully practiced in the realm of uncertainty, which is really important because I and many people think of uncertainty as this monolithic fog, negative, don't want to go there. It's an abyss, you know, stick to the routine and the normal, what you know, et cetera. But that's not really, there are so many ways in which we can learn how to be uncertain in different modes, from daydreaming to deliberating in the moment to open-mindedness strategies, practices that allow us to do so. And then we open up the world past just knowledge into the realms of how not knowing teaches us. I think that that's really interesting and important and also fascinating because, you know, we all daydream, but maybe we don't think about it and we don't think about how much we gain. Not only is daydreaming, the networks I talked about actually are the same networks used for divergent thinking, so idea generation and creativity, but also daydreaming is really important to self-invention, to human flourishing. Mary Helen E. Mardino's Yang's longitudinal studies with challenge youth show that those who daydream are actually, you know, are more successful socially and in school. They do more abstract thinking. They're just, able and the transcendent thinking to flexibly consider different options and different ways of being, as she puts it, is really important as life. You can see, you know, you can see how that elevates us. And Leonardo da Vinci said, confused things rouse the mind to invention, which is true of ourselves and true of works of art or what have you. It's really interesting.
There's an intentionality, I guess, in a sense, to what you're just saying, which is we're not talking about this fog of wandering. I mean, it can be there too, but there, first of all, there can be an intentionality behind that space of allowing for us not to know, and this daydreaming, this transcendence. So I really can see how daydreaming could help a person. They're basically coming up with future projections that don't necessarily line up with what would be predicted, but that's a beautiful thing sometimes because what would be predicted might not be the path we want. So I love that the daydreaming kind of lets us get out of these already established identities. So there's that. The other thing it just makes me think of too is that some people get uncomfortable with this idea that they would just let their mind kind of wander and do all this. How I want to also introduce just something into that is that what people sometimes don't realize is that they think they are maybe they're lost in thought, but there often is a very strong rumination to it. So they're actually locked in on a very specific valence, in a sense, to what they're thinking. So it might have a very negative flavor to it. And then all of a sudden the other networks are lighting up of all the other things they didn't do or all the wrong things that person did. And so they're actually getting very locked into a rigid kind of thinking. So when we're saying wandering, and to me, really opening up our mind to what else could be possible though? What else is there? To me, you might actually get out of that locked kind of thinking that doesn't always really serve us or even make us feel very good. So allowing for the space of uncertainty can actually, I think, help us get out of some of that very rigid you know, negative often and defeating kind of thought patterns. So I love it.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And people tell me all the time, whether it's a psychologist who is admitting uncertainty for the first time to group therapy, you know, when the clients are learning tolerance of uncertainty, the practitioners are learning to admit their own uncertainty and share their own humanity. They call that liberating. Mm. And then so many other ways in which people have told me that contending with uncertainty and you know, sort of, again, taking it out from behind the veil or wherever is really liberating. And as well as people use the word courage, it gives them courage because they are practicing rather than hiding from. Now, there's one study from the pandemic that showed that people who are highly intolerant of uncertainty, that is, they see uncertainty, the unknown and the unsureness that comes with it, as threatening versus just challenging, they were the ones who turned to strategies to cope with the pandemic of denial and avoidance, which is not healthy living. Healthy, it's not flourishing, it's retreating. And that's, you know, if you can't deal with uncertainty, you can't deal with life. And there's so much, you know, so much to this. So I think, yeah, you're right. Space of possibilities is another term that everyone from roboticists to cognitive sciences have used to talk about uncertainty. They literally use that same term again and again. Very, very interesting.
And yeah, denial and avoidance to me is robbing the system once again of inputs. And that's never really a good idea. We want inputs. We may not want to be conscious of all of them all the time, but we want them to play a role and come in. So what would you, just some takeaways for people. I think this is, I really hope people will take the time to read this book. It's so beautifully written. There's so much wonderful research that they can keep drawing from as well. And I know for me, there's some applications to our family lives, our relationships. I really hope people can think about how to apply this to that, that courage that it takes to be uncertain and to say you don't know. And then to that society level of how we look at the problems we're facing, whatever industry we're working in, how can we bring up uncertainty? How do we create space for that to really let new ideas start to come in? I know those are two big takeaways for me from the book. What else would you like to leave people with on this topic?
Yeah, I think we can, taking a page from the clinical interventions that are helping people with anxiety and many disorders by teaching tolerance of uncertainty, a lot of that is done through very simple practices, jumping off exposure therapy. So, you know, allowing your child to pack their own suitcase or trying a new dish at a restaurant or, you know, et cetera. And so trying on uncertainty is sort of the mantra. I think we can tiptoe, wade in, try something new. You know, you don't have to leap way past your, I'm never going to be a bungee jumper, but I will, you know, I try to incorporate more unknown. And then I would say that one of the ways we can counter the sort of corrosive pressure of our society to come to an answer, to, you know, not allow the liminal space, is to, you know, try sometimes in a situation, a challenging situation, not to fix it. So I learned, one of the things I took away from writing this book was that when someone is in distress, a family member or a friend, I used to think that my best job would be to come in and suggest. And I know people do that to me. And, you know, even if they've lost a loved one, you know, this is what you can do and this is how you fix it. And now I just remain, I inhabit the question with them and try to explore the uncertainty to the degree that they feel comfortable doing it. I'm there in the uncertainty. That's when you see multiple possibilities, not when I'm trying to fix it for you. And so not fixing it comes along with not labeling it. Be aware, metacognitively aware of how we label the neighbors whose politics we loathe. We name, you know, as you spoke so eloquently about, we label that cousin, you know, who's always been the X one or done X, Y, Z. And then the third thing I'd say is, just all of this takes a little time. We don't have to go off to the mountaintop and be uncertain for years or months or, you know, even hours. I mean, the best surgeons take a little time to be unsure and harness their uncertainty for better, to gain the better answer in a few minutes. And so we can incorporate these little threads of uncertainty in all the different guises that they come from. There's not just one way to be uncertain. So as we learn and incorporate uncertainty in our world, I think we'll find that, yes, it's liberating. In small doses.
Beautiful. And yes, small doses and those last examples you gave, not labeling immediately, not trying to fix that person immediately. What you were saying when you said inhabit the challenge or inhabit the problem with them is what we're doing is attuning. And attunement is one of the biggest factors for secure relationship, for mental health in terms of how we have social support. So I love that. We're talking about a sense of attunement to life, to everything that's emerging. So just beautiful. Thank you so much for being here. Can you just list off a few places where people can find out more about you?
Oh, yes. Well, my website is maggie-jackson.com. So maggie-jackson.com, or you can Google Maggie Jackson Uncertain. You'll find lots of press articles, interviews, all sorts of resources there. You can find me on LinkedIn and Facebook. In many different live events. My events page is there too. I'm going to be in Michigan and Chicago maybe LA and all over the East Coast. And so upcoming talks are all over the place. So yeah, I'd love to see you and hear from you.
Yes. Yeah. Your website's great. So that's probably my recommendation for people to go, and all your social media links are there too. So yeah. Lovely. Well, thank you so much for this beautiful interview. I really enjoyed it. And thank you for this book.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for such wonderful points and for a fantastic conversation. It gave me a lot to think about.
Thank you for joining me for that episode. As always, I appreciate if you can leave a review and subscribe, as well as share this with whoever you think might find it helpful to hear this kind of information. And there's a lot of new stuff coming up, so I thought I'd share a little bit of that with all of you. First is a new PDF toolkit that I'm going to be sending out to subscribers. And it's going to be on the topic of paradigm shifts. So how we cultivate paradigm shifts using embodied social neuroscience. So it will be a free gift for subscribers. So make sure to add yourself to my newsletter, which is at stephaniefay.com, and let others know if you think they might be interested in that topic. I'm also offering something for a limited time until June 2nd. And this is called the Neurointegration Breakthrough. So what it is when you register for $57, so I'm trying to keep this at a low price point, you can have me take a look at your website or presentation, online course, anything that you might be working on that I can see on a screen in some format. And I will screen record and offer suggestions as to how you can insert or infuse some form of embodied social neuroscience into that content or whatever it is you're working on. And any other kind of helpful tools that I can offer you, I will give during that little recording. to give you some sense of how you can have a little more neuroscience support for whatever impact it is you are having on whatever it is you're working on. So I thought this could be a really fun way to get to know a lot of you and what you are doing in the world, what you're contributing, and to create that kind of connection. So I will be doing it until June 2nd, and I will have very limited spots as well for that. And then I'll reassess if we do that again. So check that out at stephaniefay.com/neuroscience. I have all of my different options on there, as well as the Paradigm Shift Toolkit's going to be listed on there. And then a couple other packages to give you an opportunity to work with me one-on-one to help you increase your impact using neuroscience. So there's the NeuroCoach program, and that's still quite limited and a selection process, but I am still looking for people for future spots as well. So you can learn more about that as well. I have some amazing clients that I'm working with and just loving the process of really helping people understand how powerful their work is and how much more it can have just an extra edge to it by having neuroscience frameworks and terminology to support what people are doing. So I do offer a significant discount to anyone who is working in public education, veterans, first responders, law enforcement, and anyone serving those populations. So definitely pass that on if you are someone that works in those fields or know of somebody who would benefit from having some more neuroscience in their work, in their line of work. So there's a couple of options with that as well. That's the NeuroCoach program, but I have a slightly less commitment version of that as well, neurointegration sessions. So check all of that out at stephaniefay.com/neuroscience. And slowly I'm building two courses. So one is just going to be a mini book, mini course. That's going to come up pretty soon. And then an online intensive course will be up this fall. Hopefully you'll keep staying tuned to all of this and I can share a lot of that with you. And if you have any questions or topics, there's a couple of really exciting guests that are going to be on the show as well coming soon. I'm excited to share that with you guys. And let me know if you have any other suggestions. You can email me at hello@stephaniefay.com. Thank you for joining, and I will catch you in the next episode.